You have taste in a way that's meaningful to software people.
Hello, I'm Bill Gates.
I would recommend TypeScript.
Yeah, it writes a lot of code for me, and usually it's slightly wrong.
I'm reminded, incidentally, of Rust here.
Rust.
Congressman, iPhone is made by a different company, and so, you know...
You will not learn Rust while skydiving.
Well, I'm sorry, guys. I don't know what's going on.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today about large neural networks. It's really an honor to be here.
Rust.
Data Topics.
Welcome to the Data
Topics Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to Data Topics Unplugged, the casual, lighthearted, corny, cozy corner of the web. Where we discuss what's new in data, from AI models to Fabric to apparently SemVert, right, Bart? Anything goes. Today is the 22nd of March of 2024. My name is Murillo. I'll be hosting you today. And I'm joined by Bart.
Hi.
And Sam. Hey, Sam.
Hello.
Sam is a friend of the pod. He's been here. He's, again, it's the second repeat guest, Bart. Paulo was the first one, or...?
Probably. The first one. Yeah. But some is our unit of measurement. Maybe you need to explain it for the people that were not here.
And people that are not following us also on the live stream. We are on live stream, by the way. We're on YouTube, LinkedIn, X, Twitch. Is there another one, Bart?
LinkedIn.
LinkedIn. Well, I think it's LinkedIn, but and Twitch is the only one that maybe. It's been neglected. It's like the ugly duckling. Like there's nothing there, but we are there. And for the people that are following us on the live stream, you can probably see, and we're commenting before we started recording, that Sam looks really tall, even seated at the couch. So Sam is.
Yeah, we're using a special fisheye lens so just to get him on the screen.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, it's like a negative zoom kind of thing. So yeah, I'm not. It's not that I'm short. It's just the same stall for the people that were that are watching. You know,
it can also not be both. Huh?
How tall are you, Sam?
1.96 meters.
1.96. Yes, yes. I think you're the tallest at DataRoots.
Well, there was one guest that you had that had exactly the size of one Sam.
Yeah, yeah. I remember.
How many Sams are you in length?
Too many. I don't want to. How many Sams are you?
You don't want to publicly. I can quickly.
So Bart, for the people that are joining, Bart today he woke up seeking blood. So
I'm my length is 0.9 Sams.
You're 0.9 Sams. Yeah. Oh, that's pretty tall, actually. I wouldn't have. How many Sams am I?
I think I'm just gonna go by guesstimate here. You're 0.89. So still,
okay,
sounds high.
Exactly. Yeah, it sounds pretty. Yeah, yeah. See, so you heard it here first. I'm tall. If you ever met me. And yeah, like Sam, maybe I think last time we talked was in. Do you remember, Bart? It was like last year for sure.
I would say September, October, last year.
Already. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. But any life updates? Any exciting things? I'm a bit.
In my life?
Well, yeah,
over
sure.
The last 6 years.
Over the last, yeah, yeah, yeah. Over the last, any exciting updates?
No, nothing special, no.
Are you sure?
Nothing has happened?
No. I don't know, but... Okay.
Titles, prizes, no? Roles?
No, nothing.
Huh? Since... yeah, that's what you're looking for.
Yes.
So in basketball, how do they call this? very valuable players?
Yeah, it's something like, yeah. It's like, no, it's not very, it's like very valued, no? The most
valuable,
yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, but for, yeah, I didn't think about it. For me, it's...
It's normal. So I was expecting that. No, it wasn't reward, it was just a recognition.
That's not it. So I got a Microsoft MVP award
in
January.
Can we get the clap? The clap. Yes. Go Sam.
But yeah, it's in something that you... so first you nominate it, and then there's a whole procedure, and then there's the application procedure. And this takes quite some time. So I remember that I had to fill in lots of questions while I was on summer holiday. So I didn't trick for me in my head. It's not something I did over the last 6 months, but even
just, it was just a Tuesday for Sam. Like, yeah. Woke up, became an MVP. It's fine. It's fine. But not only that, huh? There was also, there was more than that, no?
I also received a DBT, was it Community Award in name? I think so. Well, they have a program that they always had in DBT, the Community Spotlight, where I was in then. And then this year, they also give awards to people who contributed to the community significantly. And since I organize a Belgium DBT meetup, and it's a few pull requests, I received a reward this year.
Really cool. Really cool. And you're also a core contributor at DBT?
Yeah, I last time I checked, I was like number 35 on DBT core, still number one or two on the DBT adapters for Max.Fabric, SQL Server, Azure SQL, Azure Synapse. There I did lots of different things.
Cool. In fact, I think the DBT Fabric, actually, you started it, right? And now it's on Microsoft, but...
I didn't start it, no. This is something started, but I hope that I don't forget anyone or mispronounce the names. a guy called Jacob. I don't remember the last name. It was M, because his GitHub username was Jacob M or something. And then someone named Michael Ene or Mikael Ene took it over. I think he's from Denmark or Sweden. And then the next person to maintain it was Anders Swanson, who then joined DBT Labs as an employee, and then did not have any time anymore to work on that, since he does that same kind of work now for all the adapters. And yeah, I was still using the adapter, needed new changes, updates to it, so I took it over then.
Cool. Really cool. Really cool. Really cool news.
And DBT, it's impressive for, news.
Indeed.
I've been wondering, like, when I hear all these achievements, I'm thinking to myself, like, what have I been doing with my life the last 6 months?
I gained 2 kilos. It's like,
it's like, what is happened? Something I continuously do well. Like, I didn't contribute to it over the last 6 months, and now someone else, I think Ty was his name, did all the work to get it to DBT 1.7 or something, and then our colleagues here at Data with Steven did the work on DBT Fabric to bump it to later versions.
Really cool.
Arthur and
cool.
And we've been talking about DBT. What is DBT? Is the dialect behavior therapy thing?
Yeah, exactly. The dialectical behavior therapy, something in the psychology world. That's what you get when you Google it, and or if you write it in caps, and people know me over the time. My eyes start twitching when you write it in caps. The DBT is a tool to transform your data. They built a tool that you can use to transform your data using SQL. And it helps you apply the best practices that we know from software engineering onto data transformations in SQL. And yeah, they're compatible with any database, any data warehouse. And if it's not compatible yet, then someone will make an adapter for it, like I contributed there. And yeah, there's lots of things to talk about. DBT, they have a cloud version, a core version, and so on.
Yeah, really cool. It's a really cool piece of tech. I feel like it's been getting a lot of traction in the past years. Really cool. Also, if whoever is listening, watching, wants to check out Sam's work, there is his blog post. He has a lot of stuff on Fabric and DBT as well. I think Fabric, the story with Fabric doesn't stop here, right? I think you're all like for MVP for Microsoft, there is something with the... Is there something related to Fabric on the MVP title, or is it just Microsoft MVP?
So you get nominated and awarded in a certain category. And for me, it's data platforms. And then within that category, you can be assigned multiple technologies, one or two, I think. And for me, it's Microsoft Fabric, and then tools and connectivity. Oh. Well, that's a link with DBT there.
Yeah,
and I think since quite new that there are not much other people who have that one. on Fabric yet, yeah. But a lot of MVPs will get renewed. I probably know also doing more with Fabric, so.
So do you have to renew the MVP title as well?
Yeah, every year, yeah.
Ah, okay.
So it's really like an award that's valid for 1 year and then you might get renewed or not.
Okay.
If you see my content, there is some work to be done there for next year.
I wasn't going to bring it up, but since you did.
I don't know. I know.
No.
During the winter, I usually don't do a lot of community stuff, contributions, blog posts. This is something I like to do in the summer.
Hmm. Interesting.
You need sunlight for this.
Yeah. So I like to sit outside and then.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And then maybe play a bit with technology, write some blog posts. Or go running, and then in my head, I already start to prepare the post.
Bart's like, oh, when I run, I'm just listening to music. I just...
Yeah, I actually listen to podcasts a lot.
Okay.
I think running is indeed good to for creative thought process as well.
Uh-huh. And I heard, I feel like I need to be careful when I say around Bart, as you will, everyone will know by the end of this podcast episode. But one thing I heard is that like running, doing these activities that is like you don't have to focus too much in the activity itself is good for learning, for creativity. I think the analogy that they did is like the brain is like pins on the pinball thing, and the thoughts are like the ball. And when the pins are really close together, it's more likely that like you're activating areas of your brain. But like when you're running, it's almost like the pins spread around. So you have more connections with things that maybe you wouldn't do when you're just focused on the task. So they were advising people that to learn effectively, you should also alternate between deep focus, but also this like passive focus, like you're running or you're doing this or doing that. So there is some. I also know a personal story from someone that was like, yeah, I had this bug and I couldn't solve it. I spent like 3 hours on this and I went to play football that night. And then in the middle of the game, I was like, oh, I know what's wrong. I just left just to solve the bug. So maybe there is some truth to that. And we touched on Fabric. We're going to dive in a bit deeper there. Bart has one very...
Maybe before we dive in, for the people that listen to us, I'm pointing upwards to the wall. Really, what is above me?
It's a duck, painted duck, hand painted. Yeah, by who's the? If you want to buy this, who's the artist that actually did this part?
It's Alex.
Yes. Can we get a round of applause for Alex as well? Yeah, Alex actually she did this hand painted. You know, like part of her responsibilities at Data Roots Bart assigned her to this task too.
That's not true. This is fully on Alex. So she came up with this idea.
Yeah.
It looks really cool.
It looks really cool. So
thanks, Alex.
Indeed. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Alex is also responsible for the design.
Is a duck now officially our mascot?
I think so. Huh? I think Bart is like he's the one that picked the duck. He went with it. He did the logos. He did everything. And then he's like, "Oh, is it the real mascot?" I was like, "Well, Bart, it's
never discussed it, right? But it was a mascot.
Yeah,
from now on, it is the mascot."
That's Bart's strategy for everything. He does stuff, and then after 2 years, he's like, "Oh, it was never official. You know, I wasn't trying to push anything."
But we're used to it now, right?
Yes.
And right. Does the mascot have a name?
What is the name, Bart? I'll let you.
Quackers.
Quackers. Okay. Quackers it is. I like it.
Quackers McFluff. I think it needs like a bit more
and maybe
a bit body more to it. Quackers McFluff.
So you went with a duck, right? Duck as a mascot. You were the one that initiated. Is there a backstory to it?
Not really. Like I just think often about ducks.
Really?
Yeah. I think that's... not consciously. Like this is just...
I feel like there's a lot to, you know, a lot to unpack there. I'm not sure if I have enough time. So maybe I'll
think that's something for another episode.
Yeah, maybe this is something for another episode.
But there's a lot of data tooling that's related to ducks. Huh? Oh, we have sure, DuckDB, right? Obviously. But you see there are prefect ducks and they call him Marvin.
Ah, really? Why Marvin, you know?
No, that I don't know.
Maybe you want to show for the camera.
I think Quackus so. McFluff is a better name.
Yeah. I think it's more. Yeah, there we go. And I think for Prefect, the company itself has nothing to do with ducks, the logo, but I think the idea with duck, like, is like the, as a developer,
Debug duck.
What is that part?
I think it's better for Sam to explain.
Yes.
It's been a long time for me. It's like your companion to debugging, right?
But it's like I usually don't do bugs, so I don't know. I don't know how y'all solve that. Just don't put that in the first place. What is that?
So I'll explain it here. I have the text in front of me. So it's called rubber duck debugging. It's a method of debugging code by articulating a problem in spoken or written natural language. And it references a story in a book somewhere, programming book, where a programmer would carry around a rubber duck and debug their code by forcing themselves to explain it line by line to the duck.
Oh. Huh. Did you try?
No.
So I learned to code by myself and so on, but then on my first job, it was I worked together with someone who was self-employed, a very small company, so he and his wife, where I learned a lot of what I know today on software engineering. Mm-hmm. And he taught me that explaining the issue often solves the issue, just because you also start to connect the dots in your head that you wouldn't do otherwise. And he told me, just pick a rubber duck. And he gave me one, and then put it next to your desk. And then when you don't know something, talk to it. And it does help, but it's super awkward, of course. So.
It's a bit awkward. When someone else sees you need to explain it, right?
Yeah.
Or maybe you just need to, you can have AirPods nowadays, and you just pretend that you're talking on the phone. That's what I do when I'm talking to myself on the street, and some people start looking at me funny. I was like, oh, yeah, okay, thank you. And I'll just take it off, and I stop, you know. That's how you play cool.
Okay.
Yeah. So, tip, you know, for you. But yeah, actually, I never heard it like explaining line by line what the code does.
No, but the problem that you face.
Yeah, that I heard. I mean, actually, I think most of us probably experienced that, right? Like you went to someone, asked someone a question, and then halfway through the question, like, oh, actually, never
that's
mind.
True. Yeah, that's true.
But I think that's the idea. Like if you're just talking to a duck, and I think the way I reason about it is for you to be able to formulate what's your problem, you have to think clearly about it, right? And I think... So pretty cool, pretty cool. And we're talking about Fabric. Your MVP for Max or Fabric? You have a question, Bart?
I have a question, but I was asked not to ask the question, but I'm going to rephrase it. So I was wanted to ask, what is Fabric? But apparently it's a very broad question. So I'm going to try to rephrase it a little bit, because I am interested in it. In a sense that Fabric is yet something else in the data ecosystem. And I think it's interesting for people to understand, like, what can they compare it with? What does it replace? What does it not replace? Like, is it a drop-in replacement for Snowflake, or is it not? Is it something for Databricks? Is it something for Tableau maybe even? Like where does it start? Where does it stop? Like, what is the positioning of Microsoft Fabric?
So what you should look at is that today, before Fabric, you ask someone to design a data platform, and what you end up with is this huge diagram that you get with all these fancy logos and arrows all over the place, and that's usually complex for people who just want to basically query tables and see what's inside and make a report out of it. Well, that's a bit minimalistic, but that's what I want to do in the end.
In essence, that's what it is. Voilà.
And Fabric, on the Microsoft Stack, you also had this. So if you wanted to work with data, you needed Azure Data Factory to ingest data into your data lake, which is by itself not a service. Azure Storage Accounts. Then if you want to run Spark, you could go for the Spark in Azure Synapse and so on. Mm-hmm. There are lots of different things that you have to connect with. Fabric is just one thing that has everything. And I think the other two competitors who have similarly offered one service that does everything are Snowflake and Databricks. Databricks a bit more or less, because it's also cloud service in the three clouds. But I mean, if you log into Databricks, there is one platform where you can find everything that you need usually. So that's a bit how you should see it. Microsoft calls it, I think, Ava, the platform for the age of AI, for the era of AI.
Why is the era of AI there? Why is it different that makes it the platform for AI? Is it just because AI is super sexy right now?
That as well, I think. But also Fabric is really, if you want to properly work with AI, training machine models and so on, you need scalable infrastructure. And you're not going to do that on technology from 10 years ago. You need something that can easily ingest data, work with data, scale the compute capacity so that you can train your AI models or work with AI in there. So AI has many different aspects. Fabric is a platform that you can use to build your own AI solutions. It also offers lots and lots of AI features in it. Microsoft, the company known for Copilot, will obviously also see where they can put Copilot within Fabric, and they already have Copilot available in certain features of Fabric today. So if you want to get the most out of AI, both as a consumer as well as a developer, then Fabric is a platform to go to.
Cool. So I see here, so like they have the SQL, I guess, like for doing data transformations and stuff.
This is in notebooks, yeah.
This is in notebooks, right, for the AI part, I guess. So also the reports.
So it's really an A to Z kind of solution. So
yeah,
there's a way to ingest data there. So it replaces a bit like, so it has its functionality of something like Data Factory or Airflow. Yeah. You have storage, you have a query engine on top of that storage, and you also have more like the more ad hoc ways to explore, like notebooks, these type of things to interact notebooks with your data.
Yeah. Yeah. Spark functionalities, everything that you can do with Spark is in there. Real time is also a big thing in Fabric.
And is this, if we talk, for example, about data ingestion or the other components, like is this all the Microsoft things that were already there that are repackaged, or is this really something that they built from scratch?
It's a bit of both. Mm-hmm. I had lots of discussions on that on LinkedIn in the community as well, with some people calling Fabric just a rebranding of things I already had. And I disagree firmly with that. It's not a rebranding. Even that you even reused lots of branding there. Fabric by itself, so for me, put this down, I'm a data engineer, so I look more at data warehousing capabilities and so on. And the whole engine that you have in Fabric, it's called Polaris, the project, is something that I built from the ground up. It was already available in some way in Synapse as a Synapse serverless engine. But everything that you could do with serverless, that was quite limited. In Fabric, you can basically use as a fully functional data warehouse. So that's one engine that's really built from the ground up specifically for this product. Then the data factory in Fabric, they also call it data factory. And I saw people calling Azure Data Factory, calling it Azure Data, but it's not Azure Data Factory because it's also a more simpler version to use. It works in a bit of a different way. It offers more flexibility. I mean, in Data Factory, there was a concept of data sets and so on. It's not available in Fabric. And it was also something that I usually didn't find that useful. So for a lot of features that I really thought about, it's like, if we would now rebuild this from scratch, how would we build this?
Yeah.
And then that's the version that I have.
Okay. Mm. And for these different components that are part of Fabric, like how is the integration between them, the interactivity between them, in the sense that in my eyes, Microsoft was not always the greatest in this. Like there's a new service, but integrating that into another service like takes a lot of time, or like the, like how is that with Fabric?
It's quite easy. So Fabric is a lakehouse based design. So that does mean that you have storage separately, compute separately, and everything in Fabric is stored in the one lake. It's one lake because there's only one. Might seem obvious, but so everything that you have in terms of data will in some way end up in one lake. And one lake is
it's called one lake. Yeah. Not that there is one lake.
No, the name is actually one lake, like one drive or something. And within one lake, your data is there. You can consume it through the different engines. Mm. So you have the Spark engine that can read and write data from and to one lake. You have the data warehouse that can read and write data to and from the one lake. And because that one lake is a shared layer between all of them, it's quite easy to use them all together in whatever way you desire.
And does that mean that storage of data is in files, like Parquet files, or these, like how does the storage look like?
They chose for Delta Lake. Okay. So the format that Databricks originally developed, and it's now open source. There's a format that's also being used within one lake.
Mm. Because you mentioned Databricks, but is there any link between Azure and Databricks as well? I know that, like, for example, MLflow, they actually use the MLflow that is from Databricks as well. And I think, like, it's very easy to start the Databricks workspace from Azure account.
Databricks is a first-party service on Azure, so that means that it's deployed as if any other native Azure service. Deploying a Databricks workspace is the same kind of complexity as deploying an Azure storage account. Hmm. So it's really first party. And I think that Microsoft invested some money into Databricks, but they don't own Databricks. Databricks is independent. They offer their product on GCP and on AWS as well. But they share lots of technologies. So there's Delta Lake for the storage. Then there's Spark also, sort of used by Databricks and now open source in the Apache Foundation. There's MLflow as well.
And the promise then with Fabric is, like, you go there and that's all you do. You don't need to do anything else.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's also super approachable. So all the previous data features that you had in the Maxos stack were on Azure, basically. You had Power BI on one hand, but then Azure Data Factory, Azure Synapse, Azure SQL, if you want to do something there. These features are therefore a bit tucked away a bit more. Someone who works daily in Excel or even more data focused in Power BI, they usually don't go into the Azure portal and start opening services and so on in there. That was more something for data engineers, cloud engineers, and these kinds of profiles. And now, because Fabric is part of the other kind of cloud that Microsoft has, more part of the Power Platform next to Power BI, it's very approachable to another audience.
But like, if you're on Fabric, you don't, like you mentioned Power BI now. You don't need to go to Power BI because you can create dashboards already in Fabric as well.
Is it? They actually integrated Power BI in Fabric. So Power BI is one of the big parts of Fabric. If you now go to app.powerbi.com, it will just open Fabric for you.
Ah, really?
And Power BI is one of the main features of Fabric. Everything related to dashboarding, reporting has not gone away. They added lots of new features there as well. And it's also nicely integrated. There are lots of struggles if you use Power BI with your data on how to connect and so on. They also fixed that with DirectLake. So there are really cool things in there to help the Power BI users as well.
And is it really expensive? Do you know, like, what's the pricing?
No, I think it's...
It's a bit biased. Is it really expensive?
But I think it's more like... I don't know, because I think for Snowflake, some people argue it's expensive or not, but like, I think you only pay for what you use, or like SageMaker, they advertise as you pay just as much as you use, but it's just the services underneath, right? Like,
yeah.
So is it Fabric something like that, or is it a completely different?
Fabric is really built for the cloud. It's also a SaaS product, so Microsoft can optimize the costs much more than they can do with other services. And that's something you notice as a user as well, is pay as you go. So that means that you can create Fabric SKU on Microsoft Azure. And then the lowest one starts, if you keep it running for an entire month, at $250 euros or dollars, something like that, a month. And that fund can already deliver some great performance. While other data products, you sometimes need to go a bit higher in budgets for the entry level.
Yeah.
But yeah, can also go to a budget of thousands a month. It's depending on your scale.
But I think it's really cool. I think it's actually made quite a lot of noise on the from the latest Azure things. I think the Fabric is the seems like much bigger than I think Synapse was the last one I heard. But
yeah. Satya Nadella calls it the biggest innovation in data since the original release of SQL Server. SQL Server is one of the biggest database engines worldwide. So that must say something.
And maybe to come back a little bit to the storage, where you were explaining Delta Lake, which is, I think, was sort of a version of Parquet. Like it's built on Parquet, right?
Yeah.
But it's typically for structured data. Like, is there also, can you also use one lake for unstructured data? Let's say, take something random here, audio files that you want to process and drop in anything?
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. One lake is still a data lake. So in the end...
Can I see it basically as a blob storage?
It is actually a blob storage underneath.
Okay.
And what maybe blob storage for people that never heard this before?
I think an S3 bucket would be the thing that more people heard of, which is like an online file storage, right?
It's just like a folder. You just put stuff there.
Oh.
Yeah.
Dropbox.
OneDrive.
That's a bit how you should see it as well. Yeah.
Okay.
It is built on Azure Data Lake Gen 2, which is just Azure storage accounts with hierarchical namespaces enabled. So that enables the folder hierarchy in it.
Okay.
And now it's offered in another way, so underneath still the same storage service that Azure already had.
Yeah.
But with one lake, it's easier to access it.
Oh. And you mentioned also this concept of decoupling storage and compute. Maybe to unpack that a little bit for people that are unfamiliar with it, why is this a good idea? And maybe to start from like a more typical example, like something like MySQL, which doesn't have this, right? Like, why is this a good idea when you talk about a data platform?
On a typical database like in MySQL, your machine that does all the calculations, if you want to do an intensive query to join a few tables together to do some aggregations, that same machine also holds a storage classically. That means if you want to store more data, it's that same machine that you would have to increase the storage of. And it will also limit the flexibility because all data that you want to work with, if you want to do any calculations, has already to be part of that SQL database machine. Mm-hmm. If you decouple them, something we first saw with Spark a lot, that you would decouple where the compute happens and where the storage happens, then you can use very cheap cloud storage solutions like S3, like Azure Data Lake Gen 2, where you can have terabytes for only a few euros a month, and combine that with machines which are really focused on this compute capacity. That means that you can scale both of them more easily and don't have to worry about the size of your data that much anymore. A duplication of data is never a good thing because of the governance aspect of it, but you should not really care anymore if you maybe store a few gigabytes of data more or less. Is the processing that's really going to count for your cost and efficiency.
Okay.
Yeah, usually that's... storage is cheap, right? Like the thing that you're usually paying the most, the thing that drives the bill is actually the compute, and you only pay for what you're actually using. So, as you were saying this as well, I mentioned Snowflake, you mentioned Databricks. It does feel, because I know Snowflake, I think I read on their blog post or something, it's not public yet, but they are planning to offer notebooks as well. They also have like a scheduling thing, like a DAG thingy. So it's a bit primitive, you declare with SQL, and I don't even know if there's a UI that you can see the graph, but they do have something like this. Are they all kind of going towards the same direction? Like,
Well, it's a bit lucky for us as users. They probably always try to compete with each other as much as possible. And if they see that one of them has some really cool new feature that gains a lot of attraction, then they will also probably do the same thing in the other data platforms. And so interesting to see. For me, I find it a bit strange that a company of the size of AWS, for example, doesn't have such a big platform that has everything, and that we have to look at Databricks, Snowflake, Fabric for solutions. Not every company needs something of that size, of course, as well. It depends a bit, of course, like everything in IT.
What is
the right choice for you?
And maybe if I have all the options there, why would someone go for Fabric and not Snowflake or Databricks? What is the trade-offs there?
So I think Fabric, the pricing is interesting. So it starts really low. They also have a pricing model. I can talk more about that, where you really see that it's a SaaS product, and that Microsoft is the only one who can do this, since they own both the cloud, the actual data centers, as well as the product. So they have the capability to scale everything efficiently and to make sure that all resources are used as cost optimal as possible. Mm. So in terms of pricing, if you compare them, Fabric will usually be one of the more interesting ones. Then the accessibility. So since now it's a brand new platform designed for the today's business needs, with a few episodes ago, we talked about an analytics engineer. That's also the main persona to use Microsoft Fabric. Mm. It becomes more accessible, right? So where you before needed a team of a cloud engineer, a data engineer, maybe it shouldn't be a job, but a DevOps engineer as well often. Then the BI person who does the dashboarding, and then maybe some analysts to understand what's happening. With Fabric, the technology has become so approachable with lots of low-code solutions as well, that everyone can start to use it.
Like low-code solutions, you mean like creating the tags with drag and drop and stuff, or?
You have lots of cool things in there for low-code. So you can need to drag and drop within the Data Factory tooling to just say first this task, then this transformation, connect them with arrows together and so on. The Power Query feature from Power BI was quite popular amongst the users of Power BI. That's also available within Fabric, so that you can transform your data with data map data flow gen 2 is the name, I think.
What does that do?
It's a view like in Power BI that you have a table and then the ribbon on top, like in every Office tool, and then say pivot or transform, or maybe if you have a CSV and your header row is the one, these kinds of things you can
start manipulating the table by interacting with the table itself instead of having to write
in stuff. The UI. And even then, for the people who prefer to code in a notebooks, you can ask Copilot to code for you. That's also quite easy. And they also have a data wrangler where you can also get thrown into a table interface, do the transformations, and it spits out a Spark code for you, documented and all.
Really, really cool.
So you have a mix of everything. If people want to code, they can code. If people want to use the UI, they can do so as well.
And so you mentioned Spark, so you still run Spark on Fabric?
You can. So Fabric has several different engines running on top of this one lake. One of them being Spark. One of them is the SQL-based engine, which the project name was Polaris, where you interact with your data in SQL. So you can also use dbt to transform your data. You also have the streaming part of Fabric, the KQL, Custom Query Language database. So it depends a bit on what you prefer as a user. If you're a team that wants to do everything in SQL, then you can do SQL. If you're a team Python as a preference, and that's also possible.
And maybe to jump on Polaris. Polaris is a query engine that they built from scratch, right?
Yeah.
Which is still relatively young. Like, are there limitations to Polaris today? Are there reasons not to go for Polaris? Because it is their native query engine.
No. So I was at a conference in Denmark, the first data platform conference that was a lot about Fabric. And one of the main, I don't know his official title, so Bogdan Krivat, he leads the engineering side for Polaris now for the implementation, I think. Everything related to Synapse, SQL, and so on, it's his thing. He explained that, so the engine is ready to use. What they need to do now a lot is expose all of these features to the users.
Okay.
So the engine is there, but maybe the SQL syntax to talk to it is not there yet, and then they might need to add it. So there are some limitations on the SQL language that are still there. Some parts of the T-SQL dialect not supported yet, but it's just a matter of prioritization and backlog and so on for a lot of them to see when they would arrive. And that's work that is going to happen probably in the coming years, depending on the need, of course. Then in terms of performance, they keep on improving, working with larger data sets. As far as I recall, they could comfortably work with a few petabytes now, but not enough for every company. So they keep on increasing that. And if they increase on the higher scale, you obviously also notice the benefits on the lower scales.
Do you know what it is implemented in? In which language?
Rust. Just kidding. I don't know.
No, I don't know. I would guess C++.
Okay. I have something embarrassing to admit. Polaris.
That's the... Hold on, everybody stops what they're doing. Just
we heard about Polaris, I don't know, almost a year ago now? Like the first, maybe even longer. Time flies. And actually, but I heard it like in passing, like they're building this.
I remember this.
I heard it in passing, and I thought it was about Polars. This is a query engine built in Rust. And I thought, okay, cool that they're using Polars at Microsoft.
So what you heard is that they're using it. You didn't hear like they were building it.
Well, I heard it in passing, this announcement, and I was assuming like Polars is going to be the query engine on Microsoft Fabric.
Never questioned it.
And it's only, but like, don't record this. I think it's only like 6 months ago that I realized, oh shit, this is something else. This is not Polars, this is Polaris. So yeah, there's that.
Okay. It's okay, but as we all make mistakes, see, just remember the grace that I'm extending to you. Because later I see they're
you're a bit anxious for the hot take, eh?
I don't know, but like you got me on my edge, you know. It was like, okay.
I went into the history of it a bit to understand where they started,
mm-hmm.
and they published a research paper, I think, in 2020 in the VLDB.
Already that long ago, okay.
Yeah. And this was like the conference where all cool kids with database engines come to show off their database.
Is this it?
Yeah. Right. And so there should be a research paper linked to it. Yeah, voila, that's the one.
Oh, wow, lucky.
And you see the first name there, Joseph Angular Seborit. He is the main author of this paper. Sorry, what I did. You have all these names there.
Yeah.
Go to their LinkedIn and see when they started working on a new project that I call research project or something within Microsoft. And it seems that they started project 2018. Okay. I never got the official information or something. But from what I see from lots of these people's career history on LinkedIn, that must be 2018 somewhere that I started the project.
Interesting. And this is the conference or is the research group? Very large databases. From what moment onward are you allowed into this group?
I have no idea.
It needs to be very large, like, right?
You're just large.
I think this is where the snowflakes and BigQueries and so on are presented.
Okay.
When they create their new stuff.
I was actually looking for the paper, but I cannot find it here.
I linked it on my blog in the post about it.
Let's see.
Everybody go to Sam's blog. It's on the screen, debruyne.dev.
If you go to the list, entire blog thing there. And then, which blog post was this? I think there is Microsoft Fabric rebranding thing. So the second one on the top. If you look there for Polaris.
We'll link to the link in the show notes.
Paper here.
Yeah. There we go. Yeah. So this is the paper. We'll definitely link it through.
Yeah.
Yeah. And do you actually like, do you monitor these people still? And then when they're like, oh, we're working on a research project, you're like, something's up.
Shit, they started on something new.
But I'm going to buy more stocks from Microsoft.
There's something interesting in the paper that also never got any word out of from Microsoft. It mentions FIDO. If you control F, command F, you will find
FIDO. This.
Yeah, this thing. And there's also a paper mentioned about this FIDO, because now you see the two and it's referenced at the end. And that paper is never made public. It's okay. Within Microsoft internal. But this must be some kind of storage project, a data lake kind of thing that they wanted to combine originally with Polaris. And this never got published, or it never saw the light of day in any products. Because one lake is Azure Data Lake Gen 2. Might be they have concepts from FIDO that are now implemented in there to make one lake work.
Interesting.
Yeah, you see ADLS is something else than FIDO on that screen. Yeah.
Interesting. There's a lot of... you really went deep on the...
Maybe it's something they use internally for their own processes.
Yeah, might be, yeah.
Very interesting. Interesting. Cool, cool, cool. Maybe with all these, maybe I'll be okay to get the ball rolling.
Get the ball rolling, Marina.
Get the ball rolling. So, we talked about Fabric. I asked, how do you compare with Snowflake and things like that? And sometimes, especially when we talk about databases, so more broadly, I know Fabric is more than just that, right? A lot of times you talk about performance. And actually, you shared this post not that long ago. This is from Mother Duck. So this is one of the Duck IT companies that Bart got inspiration from before.
I don't know. Maybe I'm the OG, right? I've been using Ducks for a long time.
Sure. You have. It's true. You have. I've seen. But it's like, I never questioned it, but it never made sense either. You know, like you put like Slack status and it's like a
Milo,
duck walk.
Milo. The best things in life don't make sense.
Okay. Can we quote that?
Don't question it.
Yes, sir. But yeah, but anyways, Mother Duck. So they actually have here like the perf is not enough. Actually, you shared this originally. It caught my attention as well. And it talks about the cult of performance in databases. Actually, it gives a bit of like a benchmark. Like there's this famous TPCH and TPCDS, right? I also... I think for me, sometimes like I look at these, I spend a lot of time, especially not only on databases, but also pollers. You know, when you talk about pollers, you also see the benchmarks and pandas and DuckDB and this and that. And I spend quite a lot of time like trying to see like what's the best one. I also have this, I'm going to start a new project. What should I use? And then you kind of go in the rabbit hole. Oh, this is a bit faster here. And then the conclusion that I have a lot of the times with these databases is like, yeah, like this Polars is the best when you have this much data and you have to do two group buys and you have two where clauses and you have this and this and this, you know?
Basically when you run the TPCH.
Exactly, right? And I even did a talk at last year or 2 years ago, no, last year. That was also like, it wasn't about databases, but it was about timing, execution time for Python scripts. And I actually made a little disclaimer on the presentation saying that all the benchmarks are wrong. But not just mine, the ones that I put here, but in general, right? Like everything is wrong because unless you're doing that exact same query with the exact same amount of data, with exact this, exact that, it's not going to be
success.
But at the same time, so I said that at the conference, but then I was thinking about it. But at the same time, I do think that they're useful. They're all wrong, but they're useful, you know, because for example, pandas, it was never the top five on the... on the benchmarks, right? Which says something, right? I feel like...
What does it say?
It says that probably there are better alternatives in terms
to
of pandas, performance.
In terms of performance, speed. Yeah, yeah. Okay.
So it's like if you talk about like, I think people that use pandas today, they're using more because of the API, because it's very popular, there's a lot of documentation, it's a lot of history, right? So that makes sense. But when you talk about performance, and I think it would be the same for databases, if you have one database that is always on the top three, even though all the benchmarks are wrong... according to me, I still feel like there is value in looking at them as a whole.
Well, yeah, and no, yes and no. So, for example, DuckDB is a database that's gained lots of traction. But if you look at the benchmarks that Polaris publishes, DuckDB is not in the top 10 there. As far as I remember, maybe I don't couldn't quote me on this, but you should have to look it up. But I think what this blog post says is that all these benchmarks, they're synthetic. And like you say, they are only efficient in this benchmark, but it doesn't show what else they have. If you have a system and it can process your queries all within 1 millisecond, but it takes you 10 days to boot up the system, and then you have to wait again for 10 days to run your next query, to next set of queries, then how efficient is that then that 1 millisecond? Or if you have to type your SQL queries, and let's say you have to between every character put a dot in between, are you going to pick the fastest one or the one that you can actually use?
Yeah.
And that's, I think, what this post is trying to say as well, that your performance depends on what you need. And if you have lots of queries with joins or something and with group bys, then you have to evaluate against that. If other companies have queries and they only do selectware or something, then benchmark against that. Specifically for you, and then even if you do it on your laptop or write it on my laptop, it will already be different.
And typically what is published is very biased, because you're trying to create a story, especially if you're a company that just created a database.
We're not published if you're a second one.
Exactly. Yeah, that's why even we talked about
and there is some, I mean, there is some truth in this, huh? Like there's you need to look at it in a holistic way. I think that is a bit of the story that we're trying to make.
Is what is the business impact of a fast running query? If the impact on that same developer is that they have to spend more time writing that query.
Yeah, I also saw, I thought it was interesting on the takeaways here. What was it? Beware of the database vendor that cares most about performance that will slow them down in the long run. And I think, I mean, it's not exactly what you're saying, but I guess it's like...
Isn't this DuckDB? Isn't DuckDB very much on the quiet performance?
No, DuckDB wants to be as accessible. Well, as accessible.
Is that the main focus?
Well, DuckDB is something you can easily use. You don't have to deploy a data warehouse or something. Eh?
Ah, I see what you're saying.
That's their how they want to position themselves. Because I hear them very much on very nitty gritty details on how to optimize this performance or that performance.
But then they also say in each version release that they are going to improve this or that in the next version or something.
Okay. Interesting.
They didn't write it in Rust, so it can be that performant as
first mistake.
Yeah, maybe it's also a bit passive aggressive, this, because they will probably not be allowed in the very large databases conference.
Just on the large, or just like big, not even large.
Yeah,
actually, I was looking for that benchmark, but I cannot find it.
The one for Polaris is on the GitHub as the first thing.
On Polaris, the first thing, this?
On the Polaris GitHub?
Yeah.
They publish it because they're very proud of it.
Yeah. See.
And that's written in Rust, so. Unbeatable.
Unbeatable, indeed.
So, you use this frequently? Like, you're a Pandas user, and are you now a Polaris user? Did you switch?
So if I have to use something today, myself, I start a project, I'll probably use Polaris.
Okay.
Polaris, DuckDB, if it makes sense, if it's easier for some reason. But I would. But I think it's like today is like, I mean, there's also the zero copy between DuckDB and Polaris, right? Because it's all in Arrow. So ideally you don't pay for like not copying data.
Okay.
So choosing one or the other doesn't matter too much. But most of the times now, today, when I need to use Pandas, it's like I'm on a team and the decision was kind of made. You know, if I'm on a team with other data scientists, everyone's using either Pandas or sometimes it's Spark because I don't know. So then I'll just stick to that.
Okay.
Yeah. Why? I feel like you had a...
No, I was just wondering.
But the Pandas 2.0 is also...
Yeah, Pandas 2 is now...
Huge improvement.
I used it like in the very beginning, but it was a bit finicky still. like I think the column types were a bit like, even the rendering was a bit different, and because it's like a different type in the back. So, but yeah, I'm sure that it's better now. But the thing I don't like about pandas, to be honest, is there are so many ways to do the same thing. You know, like you want to create a column, you can do data frame brackets, column name equals value, right? That's fine.
You can also do iterrows, and then
you can do iterrows, but you can also do like the df.assign, like with the like the chaining thing, which is also the way I prefer, right? So I feel like there are so many ways to do it, and I do think that even Spark or Polars, you know, they kind of, because they have one way and it's a bit opinionated, it kind of encourages people to do things the same way. Like you can do, you can have pandas functions that are just dot method, dot method, dot method, and do a whole bunch of times, and then you have the transformation at the end. You can do that, but that's not what most people do, I feel. And I think that's the only thing, like when I look at it, it's harder for me to read and understand what panda code, what the pandas code is doing.
So you know where you don't have this in SQL?
That's true. You don't have it in SQL. I like SQL too. I like it.
I don't transform my data in Python anymore.
Never.
With all the stupid brackets. It's yeah, too much.
Do you prefer Python over SQL? Really?
For doing data transformations?
Huh?
No, not really. Actually, I think I would say like, usually my... I think there's a lot of ifs, right? A lot of, qualifiers. But I think most of the times the data, if you're manipulating the pandas because the data is in a database already or something that like you can query it, right? So then I think if you're already in that, just use SQL, just query the data as far as you, as much as you can, and then go for Python if you really need it.
Okay.
But I think most of the times you don't need it. You can do quite a lot with SQL.
Mm, I agree.
And I also think, yeah, indeed, I think it's much easier to do something very complicated in Python, and I think it's harder to do that in SQL. It's still possible to do something that you cannot understand when you read afterwards.
Mm.
Same time, SQL forces you to make it readable.
Yeah, indeed. Mm. Indeed. I think that. I mean, there's still exceptions, I feel. Like, yeah. You still see some SQL codes like, man, what is this, you know? But in general, I do think the SQL forces you to do something that is more readable. It's more organized. It's less flexible, but then in the long term, you know, so especially if you're on a large team.
I think I can still do spaghetti SQL code.
Bart says, hashtag proud. No, I've seen, I mean, I can probably do it too, but I still think like if I'm working on a team and I'm not super 100% sure the people there, I think if I say everyone does SQL, I rest more assured at night. I sleep better knowing that when I wake up the next day, I'll be able to understand and debug it and all these things. You know.
It's a bit what DBT brought in the SQL world though. And so, yeah, you can have these SQL statements with 10 subqueries and so on. That's still requiring a few paracetamols to digest.
But yeah, I think DBT is actually very interesting too, because it does... there's SQL, but I feel like before SQL was more of a, you just do a query, but now DBT came with like a structure, you know, that you can almost like build the pipelines, you have some standards, you can get version these things, you don't get, you know, so I think I quite like it. Quite like it. Maybe a quick link to DBT. One thing I saw on DBT here is that DBT 1.8 is coming out.
Yeah.
And actually they're coming with unit testing.
Indeed.
How does DBT unit testing differ from DBT tests?
DBT tests the data. DBT unit testing tests your code.
That's very elegant. I was expecting a harder time from Sam too. It's like my job.
Create macros, mm-hmm. you want to test them before you use them somewhere in the data that you need. And this is what the DBT unit testing should solve. There have been lots of community projects to do so, and now it's going to become part of DBT itself.
Let's say you have a macro. I mean, you still need like a fragment of test data then somewhere, right? Like typically DBT, you run against an actual database and you can test whether or not an apply is successful, and you can pseudo test that way, but you need to do it against your actual database, right? And is it with unit test then that you have like a fragment of data that you define, or you define like asserts that you expect, or
I haven't looked into the final spec yet. That would be coming out. But okay. This is the page that has it. They have found a YAML way, of course, yeah. to define of course,
yeah.
it.
Here they showed actually, like for a given input, if you zoom in a little bit, Marilo is showing the spec here on the screen.
Yeah.
That for a given input, a number of rows, they you can define also a given expected output.
But it would be interesting to see if they run this in your database. Or does it stay within dbt core?
Well, I hope it stays in dbt core because then you can really isolate it. Eh?
Yeah.
Becomes much easier to test it also, like setting this up locally. And.
But then but there are differences on the SQL dialect, right? If you do it locally, how would you?
Yeah, that's a fair point. That's a good question.
Yeah, but that doesn't matter that much since you're not testing the execution of your SQL, but the execution of your Jinja. Do you see? So it's dbt has the templating language Jinja is being used in dbt to make your SQL more flexible.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. While if you would want to do something on the same operation on 10 columns, you would have to copy paste in the SQL. That's what Jinja solves for you. And the unit testing feature is not, the goal is not to test your SQL code, but to test what you have created within dbt, within Jinja, and so on.
So it tests. So if you explain, do I interpret that correctly, that it tests the correct templating, the execution of the Jinja templating, and not the logic of the template?
As far as I understood, yeah, that's the case. Okay. So if you have macros and so on. Okay. But here I also see that there are some data tests with CSVs. I have to better look into
it. We're gonna do a deep dive and come back to this.
I think this is still coming out, right? So, but I think it's cool. I think that's actually something that I was thinking through when I was setting up dbt on a project. Like, oh, how can we make sure that things are good? So this is something that I was thinking. So really cool. Excited to see what comes out of this.
Usually I learn about these things when I have to make changes in the adapters, but this time apparently there are no changes needed in adapters. I can do it with everything that I already had.
Nice.
There's less updates needed.
And somebody's like, but I wanted to learn more about it. Like,
well, now I have to dive into this code.
Yeah. Cool. Do we have a bit more time for, talk about Reddit part?
Oh, Reddit. I think we don't have enough time.
We don't have enough time. We have
to Reddit IPO'd.
Well,
the crazy valuation, I think, 6 billion, something like that. I think they opened at, you're putting it on the screen here, they IPO'd at $34 per share, but I think they ended the day at something like $50.
Really?
But let's see where we're at a month from now, right?
Right, the CEO is one of the best paid CEOs in the big tech world. Huh?
And there is a huge amount of discussion on it, because like moderators are volunteers.
Yeah.
And moderators have not been treated very kindly by the CEO in the past.
Really?
It's not that long ago they turned black.
Yeah. Reddit went quote-unquote black. A lot of communities closed because they banned all more or less all third-party applications that connect to them. Or they not banned them, they ask a shit ton of money to connect basically with your API, which like your kind hobby developer that built a cool tool, like simply can't use it anymore.
Yeah, I know that I was playing with like fetching data from Reddit real time to try some like streaming stuff. And I think I was like, there was a lot of questions on, I don't think I'll be able to do this anymore because now you need to pay a license. You can do this, you can do that. So
I think there is still, you can use it for free if what you do is fully for free and there is no, I think that is the.
But then it's like, do you need to request it or do you have it? But then if you violate the terms, then you may be. Is there like a process for me to.
You're going to try to stay under the radar? Or?
No comment.
But let's see what it gives to the community. Yeah? We've had a lot of shocks to the community. I think with the third-party things was a bit of the biggest one. They also have, not that long ago, there was in the news that they have a $60 million deal with Google so that Google can use their content for AI purposes.
Oof.
And LLM training purposes, which is a bit iffy, right? If I put my stuff on Reddit and then it's for free and then...
Yeah.
But Yeah. Apparently, well, for now, the stock market likes it.
But do you think that even OpenAI asked, or did they just use the Reddit data?
I think we're not allowed to talk about this.
Okay.
But let's see, it's still very early days. So far, this year, Reddit is going very good. But that was the same with Snowflake. And we all know how that ended up.
How did that end, Bart?
It was a bit of a letdown. Oof. Over time. And Reddit is a company, if I'm not mistaken, I don't think they ever had a full year where they were profitable.
Oh, really?
If I'm not mistaken, but I can be wrong on this.
But they did, like with the downfall of Twitter and X, take over lots of traffic. Yeah?
True. Yeah.
Okay. It's the right time, at least. Right,
for it's the right time, yeah.
Yeah. Cool. That was a quick, thought it was going to be more dramatic part.
No, I'm going to leave the drama for another time.
Ah, man. I like when you're dramatic. I like the drama. I mean, I think that's when you say I'm a Latino, you know? It's like, you just get addicted to it. It's like, cool. Maybe very quickly, shout outs, I guess. There was a lot of AI stuff that was released this past 2 weeks.
A lot, yeah. But let's not go into it too much. Yeah? Like, we have Grok 1 that was released.
This is it.
March 17th.
It's the Twitter one.
The Twitter X one comes from X.ai.
Yes.
So Grok is their conversational bot-ish thing.
That was woke. Or no. Was it woke?
It used to be.
It was not woke.
It was anti-woke. What is it?
It was sleeping.
It was very... what is the opposite of woke?
Combination of racist, sexist.
Yeah. When it came out, it was not political.
It was not politically correct.
Yes. It has 314 billion parameters, which is significant.
It's pretty big.
Also means that, like, there are no different versions. It also means that, like, probably no one can run this locally. I think people estimate that you need roughly 320 gigabytes of VRAM, which is significant. I can't run that. maybe also interesting is how this came to be, because it did entail a bit of drama.
Ooh.
So Elon has been bashing OpenAI that OpenAI is actually closed AI.
He sued him, I guess.
He sued him, indeed. Yeah. There's an active. Let's see what comes from it, right? But he's been really bashing OpenAI on this that they're actually closed and blah blah blah, that they were a non-profit and that they're not for-profit, and then people on Twitter reacted, yeah, but Elon X is also not open sourcing and stuff. And then the reaction of that, we'll open source it next week. So this is why it came to be.
Okay,
this is why it came to be. So we had the Grok. We had...
MM1 from Apple.
MM1, which I don't think there was a major announcement from Apple, but it was a paper that was released on archive.org, which basically shows that Apple has its first significant LLM model, which took a while, and I think everybody is expecting Apple to be to 2024 to be Apple's year into big AI / LLM / an actually working Siri. Let's see where we're at. I think MM1 is there today in research and development. There is also talks, also very recently, is that Apple potentially is collaborating with Google to license Gemini so that they can potentially leverage Gemini for their services, which a bit contradicts this, but maybe they see it a bit as a path towards their own solution in the meantime.
Yeah.
So interesting to see that Apple is also doing this. Stability AI released Stable Video. Stability AI, also known from Stable Diffusion, which is a video generation model, some a bit like OpenAI's Sora. Looks quite cool. I haven't. I don't think it's publicly available yet.
Isn't it something like 3D?
Yes.
Yeah. Specialized for 3D images, right? So it's like the.
And if you look at what they released, it looks quite impressive.
They've always been doing really cool stuff, like Stability AI. And it's always been open.
And it's always been open, yeah.
It's really cool stuff.
And last thing here on the AI, because there is so much, and we're probably skipping like 80 different announcements that have been there in the last week. A little bit of insights on GPT-4, that apparently it has more than a trillion parameters. If I remember correctly, 1.7 trillion parameters, which is crazy to think of.
Yeah.
So, for example, Grok had, that we just had, which is a big model, which is probably the biggest. Grok is the biggest open model or openly accessible. 314 billion. ChatGPT is now rumored to be 1.76 trillion parameters, which is hard to imagine. So maybe just for people that's because you hear this a lot, like, what are parameters? So in a... You've all seen like the diagram of a neural network where you have these nodes and connections and layers. If you have these nodes in a single layer, they're connected to all nodes in the next layer. And like the weights that are on these connections are basically called your parameters. So this is a bit like, how big is this model? How complex is this model? And this more or less translates to how, quote unquote, smart is this model. That's what we see in practice. The bigger, the better performance.
Yeah, I think with the transformers, the thing is that they figure out a way that they can just keep increasing and you can just kind of add stuff. Because I think before there was some issues when you got really big, like there were some limitations, but transformers, they just kind of...
And a very recent announcement from Anand, but it leaked before, also a few weeks ago, a recent announcement from some that where he confirmed that GPT-5 will be better across all domains. So, curious to see what that means.
Yeah, me too. Curious. I mean, again, I feel like we just needed to touch because this is very timely. But also, there's so much happening, it's hard to keep up.
Huh? 20 new announcements next week.
Yeah, exactly. So, we just need maybe to put the notes at the bottom of the screen, like with like the news anchors, you know?
Like
breaking news. Yeah, exactly. Like, this is, yeah.
While we're recording, like all the news that comes
exactly.
in.
Exactly. So. That would be appropriate. So cool. I think we already went over the 1 hour mark. I think not sure we have time to cover all the lots of things here, so maybe we have to keep it for another day. No hot takes today, Bart, sorry. Fine, go ahead, Bart.
Thank you. One hot take. And it's actually it comes from Rilla, but I've taken the liberty to release this as a hot take. So we were having a discussion earlier this week about this very, very small open source Python library. Yeah. What's it called again?
Expiring-lru-cache,
right?
Yes.
Which is an LRU cache, like in FinkTools, that can also expire. Where Murilo has 11,000 downloads, but that's not what we're discussing. So I was saying to Murilo, there was an issue. Someone created an issue. And I was saying to Murilo, this is, the package is still on version 0.0.5 after fixing the bug. And I said, maybe that doesn't really represent it. Huh? Like 0.0.5 is like, that seems like it's just like, I woke up this morning, I wrote 5 lines of code, and it's more than that, right?
Yeah.
And then, so we upped it. And then Murilo made the statement. So now it's 0.1.0. So it's, and that actually means that it's stable. Wait, I'm going to take the exact, because maybe I'm a little bit. He said also 0.1.0 is usually stable. And I thought to myself, I'm going to take this as a hot take. Sam is here, and I'm sure that Sam also has an opinion on this. So who do we start with to react on this? Murilo or Sam?
I don't confirm nor deny or any of the information.
I can share a Slack screenshot on this.
So I guess there was a mishap, you know, like, in a lapse in the doing of things, you know, my hectic day-to-day life, I may have.
But you can defend it, right? Like, you don't need to...
I just think so, first
is
of
this,
all.
Is this the right version number for your package now?
What is the right version, right? Like,
let's... Okay, maybe you can explain, or some, like the...
Simver.
x.y.z, like.
Well, yeah, so I can take a quick crack at this.
Yeah.
My laptop's going to die, so let's see how long I can keep this up. But basically, so this is from Semverse, from semantic versioning. Yeah. So actually each number means something.
Which is arguably the most used versioning system, right?
Yeah, I would say so. Yeah. So usually each number, so there are three numbers here separated by dots. The first number they indicate is major, and then minor and patch. And major, minor, patch means other things as well. Major means that you have incompatible API changes. So for example, if I have a function that says hi, and then in the next version, the function is called hiu, that's a breaking change because you need to change the way your code works to work with my package, right? A minor version is when you add a functionality or a feature. So let's imagine that I have hi, and I still have hi, but now I have a parameter, an additional feature that can say the name. And it has a default value. So basically, if you're using my package, it still works fine, still works the same. But now if you're using this new version, there's a new thing that you can change. There's a new capability of my tool.
But it works in a backwards compatible manner. So if you would use the old docs, exactly. It should work.
Exactly. Right? Yeah. It should, everything. So it's like the promise is, as long as you don't change the major version, everything behind should be working fine. Okay. Right. And the patch basically is like day to day. There's a little bug, something you fix, right? So this is what the patch is. So I agree with that. Like, this is also everything how it goes, right? The thing for me is, like, I also heard a lot of statements on the 0.0, right? Maybe I took the liberty as well, finding here from Tiangolo, the guy from Fast API. Where is it? Is it here? Yeah. So for example, so
I have the feeling you prepared your argument on this.
Yeah, he didn't scroll down on the page where it coincidentally might say that.
No, I think it's like, so this is this is a convention, it's a guideline. Okay, but like, what is a breaking change? What is not a breaking change? Sure. These things are a bit like it's clear, but then once you get to the degree, sometimes it doesn't get super, you know. So for example,
and you have done this example, Tiangolo is the guy behind I think it's his GitHub username, right? But this is the guy behind
Sebastian Ramirez.
Fast API
typer and SQL model.
Yeah,
so very popular Python packages, and this is for SQL model. So even he says here, test coverage is 97%, I will release 0.1 once I have 100%. So that's actually his threshold. Once he has 100% coverage, that's when it is 0.1. There are other packages now. For example, I think Great Expectations, you mentioned them.
So this is your argument?
No.
Wait, but what does this conversation about? So he releases 0.1.0 once test coverage reaches 100%, but what kind of versions does he have right now then? Does he follow Semver? Yeah. Semver would mean that he would now publish versions with 0.1.0- pre or alpha or something like that.
So SQL model, it's still not 100%. It's still on 0.0, for example. He's still on 0.0. And even though he may release features.
It's already not following Semver.
He's not following Semver, you know. And even like I think you mentioned, let's see. Well, Great Expectations is on 0.18, right? So if this was an exam and I wrote that down, I would be wrong. But in real life, you know, I think some people, they're a bit more free with the way they use Semver. Like also, for example, another argument why I heard poetry, and I had this whole thing on poetry because last week we touched on poetry. So I wanted to come back and correct some things that I said that are actually not true as well. But poetry, they use the caret, basically saying, I'll accept everything from this major version, but not anything on a breaking version. But since then, I heard a lot of arguments from people from the Python community that you shouldn't use the caret. You should really just use the greater than equals, even if it's a breaking change. Because what is a breaking change for you, for your code, depends on what functions are you using. And by allowing more functions, by allowing more versions, it's much easier for the dependency management resolver to work. So by using, and again, breaking change is just me as a developer that thought this is going to break your workflow, so I bumped it up, right? So it's like, what is a breaking change? What is not a breaking change? It's not black and white a lot of the time.
Is it?
That's his argument.
Yeah, I disagree with that.
So too. For example, there is a function that I'm using that maybe there is something that I thought it was a bug. And when I fix it, a lot of people complain because they're relying on this bug, quote unquote. So then for you, that's a breaking change.
I think, the bug. Okay, bug is a bit of an issue. But I think the example with the docs, if you create docs and And you lost your...
but it's fine.
You lost, you lost power to your computer. If you use if you generated the docs, that means for version 0, right?
Yeah.
Or you're at the version 0, 0.0, .0, then you should be able to use what you defined there all the way up to 0.1. I think that is a good definition. If not, there's a breaking change.
Yeah, yeah, for right? sure. I mean, but like you should be able to use it. But, I
doubt that that is the case for what we're showing. Fast API, right? There must have been breaking changes.
For I was using SQL.
0.0 is a special one as well.
The special one. It's a bit of it's a very special.
Yeah, but I think indeed, like the 0.0, it's like we talked about Semver. The 0.0 is a bit different because.
Maybe 0.0, like this is 0.0.0 is an edge case, right? But
yeah, yeah,
0.1.
Yeah. But like 0.1, like if you look at the Semver on that page that I was showing before, they say that 1.0 is the stable, mm-hmm. right? So basically the idea is like anything that is not one, the maintainers, they are reserving the right to break at any release, right? So basically you're saying like from 1 to 2, there's the breaking change. But if you're at 0. whatever, from 0.1 to 0.2, you could have breaking changes. Because the idea is that in software development, you want to move fast in the beginning and you don't want to be constrained by not breaking anything at mm-hmm. every point, right? At any bump. So it's a my mistake was to say there was 0.1 when in reality it was 1.0, right? And then the idea yeah. is that from 1.0 onwards, you know that there won't be breaking changes.
Okay.
You see lots of packages these days who don't, they don't, but the maintainer, takes a very long time to publish a 1.0. Yeah. I don't think that's a good evolution.
Fully agree.
Yeah. I mean,
and better to more quickly switch yeah. the major.
It's like they don't want to commit yeah. to what they have.
I think having a major release creates a bit of trust.
Yeah, but I still see, for example, Rough. Now I think they're on the 1 or maybe 0.1 or something. But even until then, it was like 0.0.287. It's like crazy.
But maybe, because we need to close this, we can summarize it two ways, right? If you're the creator of Rough, or if you're the creator of Fast API, which has 69K stars, like yeah. you do whatever the fuck you want. In all the other cases, we use the definition of Semver.
And for expiring LRU cache.
Is that a good compromise?
Okay. So that's what Bart's saying, that I need to bump to 1.
Exactly. So that your users can be confident that they can use your package.
But then I guess even like the first time we published it, we should already put it at 1. Because to be honest, like, we published it once and we didn't touch on it for like years. Like it was already pretty stable. And also even the project that is expiring LRU cache, are we going to have breaking change there? Like isn't that just stable already? Like how, you know?
I don't think anyone predicts the breaking changes. Huh?
No, but I mean like the first release, because we released at 0.0.1, I guess. Right? But it's like, we could have, might as well just release already the first release to be the 1.0.
I feel like it takes us too far, but we added actually a feature now that I'm not 100% sure how far back in Python it goes. We dropped support for a number of Python versions, older Python versions.
It's already a breaking change.
And I'm not sure how, like this new feature, if it, because it actually exposes something in an underlying Python, if it's in all the older ones, for example. You don't test them anymore.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Anyways, maybe just to wrap up as well, the versioning, I think like Python you mentioned, Python does not follow Semver. Python 3.13 is not Semver.
If you're Guido, you do whatever the fuck you want.
And there's also the if you're Dutch, right Bart? Let's make it broader.
There is Python code that you wrote in 3.0, which is doesn't work in Python 3.13, you say?
Yeah, you can. Like, no. I think so. I think there are some things that they
don't think so.
Like there was the whole pep about removing dead batteries, that they're going to remove some stuff from the standard library.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. But Python 13, like the 13 and 14 is not because they're releasing a new feature. It's like they have a calendar almost. Like every...
Yeah.
And I think again, like if you're using the standard library, like if you remove dead batteries, right? Like it's very like... Edge, right? I think the Python 4, if you had a truly breaking change, would be if they have different keywords, like the print statement. Now it's like, I think they did it from Python 2 to Python 3. Like before print, it was like print space string.
But it's also because Python has its history at
yeah
difficult to upgrade from 2 to 3.
Yeah, no. Yeah, that's why they, like Guido said, he's never going to
C# or something just follow Semver as it should.
Yeah, but Python doesn't even have a patch. I mean, actually, they do. They do have a patch version, even though. Yeah. But like the release is on a calendar, pretty much. Yeah. And there's also the Calver, right? Yeah. So you can actually make releases based on calendar. I think Black used to do that.
Or a strange Ubuntu where these things, where they do the .04 and
oh, with a cool name.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Maybe we need a cool name.
And they do the year month, right?
Like no, it's just increasing, but you always have .04. There is 04. And
I think it's a year base. I do think I'm correct. So the latest one is 23, which is the year .10.
Ah, yeah, okay.
And they typically release in October and in .4, April.
Ah, yeah. That's what it is.
Yeah. You know, Rust, they also committed to never have breaking changes. Just
the latest code name for Ubuntu is Mantic Minotaur. I think that is cool.
Yeah.
I think every version, every major version,
but I feel like that's
should
also,
have a code name.
But I feel like that's for operating systems. Like Mac also has names, right?
That's just lame. Okay. Limited to that.
We'll do it. We'll do it, Lars. Yes, sir. All right. On that, I think that's all the time we have for today. Thanks for whoever stayed with us this whole rant as well.
Thanks, everyone. Thanks a lot, Sam, for joining us.
Thanks, Sam.
Thank you for having me.
Talk to you later.
Talk to you later.
You have taste in a way that's meaningful to software people.
Wait.
Hello.
Let's not close it after this intro. I have one more thing.
Okay.
I would recommend.
You gonna pause it? Okay.
Oh wow. Okay. We can restart out.
Yes.
What would be really good? What I would be really happy about.
Hold on. I have another just quick thought. We need the disc. They go. You know, when you change that, we need that on the soundboard. Carry on.
What I would be really happy about if we can use a quote of some in the intro, so like, with like super happy intonation, like. I'm Sam. I'm very happy to be at the Data Topics podcast.
Ah, yes.
Maybe we can do this here live, Sam.
No, it doesn't have to be.
Like, let's fabricate it.
Let's fabricate it. I think that is... No, you don't...
No, it's...
Nothing.
We can just...
Just say what, like, just repeat after me. Let's fabricate it.
Let's fabricate it.
Yes! Woo! There we go.
You have taste. In a way that's meaningful to software people.
But hello. Already thinking, where's it
I'm Bill Gates. Yeah, it's like...
I would recommend TypeScript.
Yeah, it writes
include your
a lot of code for me and
obsession with
it's
bars of soap
wrong.
In this as well.
I'm reminded incidentally of Rust here. Rust.
Like bars of soap too.
Congressman, Rust. iPhone is made by a different company, and so you know
you will not learn Rust while skydiving.
Well, I'm sorry, guys. I don't know what's going on.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today about large neural networks. It's really an honor to be here.
Rust.
Data Topics.
Welcome to the Data
Topics podcast.
Let's fabricate it.